بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم، نحمده ونصلي على رسوله الكريم، أما بعد، السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته everyone. Welcome to our next session looking at the development of the Hanafi Madhab. And as always, this is just an introductory lesson or series of lessons, because of course it would take a long, long time to actually do justice to the rich legacy of the Hanafi Madhab. So with that reminder, I propose we start bi-idhnillahi ta'ala. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to share the PowerPoint slides. You should have them with you, all of the previous ones that I've delivered, and they should be available to you. Feel free to use them. If you are going to make changes, then that's entirely up to you, but please let people know that you made changes. And if you haven't made any changes, that's fine, entirely up to you. But they are for your use as you see fit, bi-idhnillahi ta'ala. So let's get this show started. I hope that you can hear me. I'm assuming you can because no one's commented. So let's get this slideshow up and running. Okay, bismillahir rahmanir rahim. So we are looking in this lesson at the development of the Hanafi Madhab. What I thought we'd do is do something slightly different to what we are accustomed to, just to get you to appreciate different approaches to understanding the spread of the Hanafi school and scholars. So in the previous lectures that I've been able to deliver, we've looked at individuals themselves. We looked at individual scholars, a little bit about their lives, a little bit about their works. What I want to do in this series of lectures is take some time out from that and look at geography, look at movements, look at shifts, look at how the Hanafi school spread in different and uneven ways across the Muslim world. So we can't do all of that today, of course, but I want to look at one locality, inshallah ta'ala, just to give you a sense of some of the interesting things that we can sense from our reading of the autobiographies and what was written during that period. And I hope that you will indulge me on this journey. So what I want to do is I want to look at the Hanafi Madhab during a very short period, if you like, or its most important period, which is about a century and a half from its inception. Now, of course, there's no exact start date for when the Hanafi Madhab came about, but we know at some point it began to emerge. And because we're dealing with social history, we're dealing with developments of ideas, development to do with people coming together, there would never really be an exact date when they sat down. It wasn't like there was a meeting, yani, and the scholar said, this is when the Hanafi Madhab starts. Okay, so we're looking about a century and a half from the inception, which is roughly the middle of the second century, which is the 8th century common era, until the end of the 3rd century, which is the 9th century of the common era. And I just want to take that period, give you a very quick overview, and then pick one location, just to give you a sense of who were the key players and what was happening in that particular locality. Now, usually when you think of ulama who were responsible for promoting and spreading the Hanafi Madhab, you can broadly give them two categories, at least in the earlier period. Now, it's worth bearing in mind the labels that they might have been given later on, like in the 19th century or the 18th century that we have now. If we went back to those ulama, they may not necessarily agree with the way which we have categorized them, because they wouldn't recognize these concrete terms the way we have them today. Having said that, we can say that there were two groups. There were those who were residents of a place where the Madhab, Hanafi Madhab, prevailed. And there were those who it wasn't the case, but they'd come there. They'd come to these lands where the Hanafi Madhab was predominant. And then they'd go back and spread the Madhab there. So one was, it was already there. It was German. And the second one would be where it's already, so one reason is that it's already there. And the second reason people have studied there and then they move on and they pass it on to their teachers. Very common, you see that same pattern today where people might study, for example, in India, in certain localities within India, and then they spread that tradition to the West, for example, South Africa or Britain or America. Or you find people who go to Egypt, Al-Azhar, and then they spread their learning, their scholarship to wherever they end up. So these ulama were not necessarily what we would call quote-unquote Hanafis, because the Hanafi Mazhab in the second century was still at its very nascent state. It was very early on. And so we didn't really have clear boundaries like we have today. That's really important because when you read back, you have to be aware that the ulama might not be, most likely, in fact, would not call themselves Hanafis because the Mazhab was still developing. Okay, and Hanafi material that we see today or material that was later labeled as Hanafi, of course, existed and it was circulating. But people who were transmitting this knowledge were not exclusively Hanafis. They weren't part only exclusively of the Hanafi Mazhab. They might have taken opinions which were later deemed to be non-Hanafi, for example. And this is worth also, this is an important point. You'll find this in their writings. And so they were, might have been, for one author, he calls them semi-Hanafis. So they would, because the Mazhab is still growing and people are still taking ideas from different places, you could call them semi-Hanafis. Of course, as time went on, the people who identified with the Hanafi Mazhab began to increase, and those who were kind of like semi-Hanafis began to decrease over time as well. And so by the end of the third century, so if we just map it out, by the end of the third century, what you see is a coming together or a tendency of loyalty towards a particular school. So initially there wasn't a name of a school as such, but eventually over a century and a half, you see that a development starts to come about. And I'm telling you this because this is the important period in the Hanafi Mazhab, if you like, which is the period from, like I said, a century and a half until the end of the third century. Now, the Hanafi Mazhab, like many schools, was a process. It wasn't a school as such, but it was a process that developed over centuries. And some people would say that it's still an ongoing process because you have a question today. It's more of a philosophical question, but it has practical implications. Has the Mazhab stopped evolving? Has it stopped growing? And does the Mazhab continue into the modern era, even into the post-modern era? Okay, because sometimes we like to historicize the Hanafi Mazhab and think that perhaps it stopped at a certain period and that was it. And everybody that came after that must just simply go back to that period and there's no evolution that's taking place. So the school developed and gradually accumulated in the course of this century's development of these Mazhab. And eventually it became known as the Hanafi Mazhab, noted after Imam Abu Hanifa. May Allah be pleased with him. Okay. And so there's a lot of conversations to be said around that. However, it's fair to say that the authority of the Hanafi Mazhab was found in certain jurists. So you have a school, but there were certain people who are a part of that school, amongst many, who were seen as more authoritative than others. And of course, that would have been Imam Abu Hanifa, for example, who we've covered. Imam Zufar, who we should cover if we haven't already. Imam Abu Yusuf, who I've covered, and you've already covered Imam Muhammad al-Shaybani, may Allah be pleased with them. And so they were seen as amongst the elite or the people who are authoritative in the Hanafi Mazhab. And so this already existed in the second half of the second century, and that's many people ascribe to them and their books' authoritativeness. And we've talked about some of their books, the Kitab al-Asr, the Jami al-Kabir, Jami al-Saghir. These books were known as very much authoritative in their own right by the scholars of the Mazhab, the early scholars that I mentioned. The final thing I want to mention before I move on is that it's also worth bearing in mind the role of the qazis, the judges, state-appointed judges as well. When we look at the Hanafi Mazhab coming together, there were qazis who followed and applied in court what the sources then describe as the teachings, the qawl of Imam Abu Muhammad, Imam Abu Hanifa, or the Mazhab of Imam Abu Hanifa. For example, you have Waqi', who was a Kufan judge. He says that he writes about the appointment in Basra of the first qazi who actually followed Imam Abu Hanifa's teachings as well. So these elements, these key elements, the recognition of the slow recognition or the slow coming together of the Mazhab, the recognition of the authority of the Hanafi masters, the existence of this, there was a doctrine of the Hanafi Mazhab and its transmission, and how it's applied in law can be ascribed to Imam Abu Hanifa. And this already existed in the second half of the second century. So they were very, very much, these things had already been set as foundational to the Hanafi Mazhab. But it's worth repeating once again that people in that time did not exclusively attach themselves to the Hanafi Mazhab. So they might have teachers who are from the teachers of Imam Abu Hanifa and who broadly follow the teachings of Imam Abu Hanifa, but you might also find that many of them were followers of other schools or other teachers as well. So can we really talk about a Hanafi school? This is the question, right? Or is it better to say a Hanafi circle? Because a school embodies this idea of a similar constellation of ulama, similar texts, similar methods of understanding Quran and Sunnah. Or should we rather say for this early period that it's better to say that it was a circle, the circle of Imam Abu Hanifa, for example. And so rather it was more fluid. And a circle kind of gives this idea that people were eclectic, people who were borrowing ideas from many ulama at the time. So very rich tradition when you start seeing it in that way. And of course, it's useful because what we don't want to do is project how we see the Hanafi Mazhab today into the past, in how, and we kind of assume that they must have seen it the same way. Rather, it's better to envision a past where it was much more cosmopolitan, it was much more diverse, the schools were still coming together. We're talking about the spread of the Hanafi school rather than its formation, but it's just worth remembering these ideas. So we have these ideas of Hanafis developing. So in the middle of the second century and to the end of the first century, you do start seeing the Hanafis and others. So you start seeing gradually the otherization, what we call in sociology, where you distinguish yourself from others. In social theory, one of the ways you create an identity is that rather than saying we are this, it's what other people say about you. It's how they distinguish you from them, right? We call this otherization. And it's very, very common. You see in popular discourse where people say he's not really this, he's not really that. They are creating an identity for themselves. They are creating identity for the others by virtue of otherization. So this starts happening around the second century to the end of the first century. I'm just giving you an overview as well. And then you have when the Mihna took place, which is the Inquisition, the famous Inquisition of the Khalq-i-Quran debate. And then you start seeing a further crystallization of the boundaries. Okay. And I'll talk about this maybe in a future lesson, where you can see this clearly in certain parts of the school. And it's worth also stressing that the Abbasid Caliphate played an important role through patronage, through appointments of judges in further emphasizing the schools of law, if you like. And I would say that the Abbasids in particular contributed significantly to the spreading of the Hanafi school, especially when it came to, among many other things, in their appointment of Hanafi judges, Hanafi qadis. So I wanted to just start with that introduction. This was just an overview, and inshallah, I'll try and give you more detail during the next hour or so. Now, where do we find out who was Hanafi and who was not Hanafi? Well, one source is what I've talked about before, is the books, the biographical dictionaries, the tabaqat genre, where you have books written, and ulama would make them, one of the ways they would do is they would say, well, this is a book written on the biographies of the Hanafi madhab. So I mentioned this before already, that you can access these, you can buy them, and you can read them, and you should read them. And there's many there. A friend of mine, a good friend of mine, Mufti Mu'adh Jatti, has made a nice little short video talking about one of those books here, Akhbar, I think it's the first one, Akhbar Abi Hanifa wa Ashabihi by Abul Hussein bin Ali al-Saymari. I'll try and maybe share that if you want later. You can watch that, so about that particular biographical dictionary. And because he's done that one, what I decided to do was maybe look at a different one. And the one I want to look at is the second one here. So we can look at many of them. But I also wanted to show you in this lesson just how we can maybe use cautiously some of these biographical dictionaries. So one of them here is what's called Al-Jawahir Al-Mudiyya fi Tabaqat Al-Hanafiyya. You can get this, you can download this. By the Egyptian scholar, I've written his name down there, Abdul Qadir bin Muhammad bin Abi al-Wafa, who died in 775. So written quite late, written quite a few centuries later, after the period that we are talking about. And so this is a copy of the book, the volume, you can download it and read it in your own time. It's very well known, so I'll call it Jawahir from now on. It's a very famous Hanafi biographical dictionary. It was written towards the end of the author's life, and it has biographies of around 2,000 ulama until then, okay? From Imam Abu Hanifa's time up until the 8th century. And it's a very important book. You have to cite it. You have to read it. You have to be able to access it if you're going to talk about history of the Hanafi school, its scholars, its movement, its shifts, among other books. The interesting thing about this book is that some authors in there, or some of the people that he mentions in there, are clearly Hanafis. But when you look at some of the earlier scholars that I mentioned in there, we can't quite tell for sure if they were Hanafis. And remember what I said at the beginning, it was quite fluid early on. So this is why you can say that you can divide scholars in that book to those who are unquestionably Hanafi. Like over time, you know that they are Hanafi. And then those who you kind of think, well, really, were they Hanafi or not? And there's a lot of conversation, and I don't want to go into it because it's an academic conversation around why the author may have included certain ulama as Hanafis and not others. And you can read all of that. I can send you more resources on that. But I don't want to get into it because it kind of takes us away from what we want to do in this particular lecture here. Now, the ambiguity, as I was saying, is really to do with this period that we're talking about. So when I was saying that, there are some who are questionable Hanafis, this is to do with this particular period that we're talking about. And that's natural because, like I said, the madhahib was still fluid. They were still forming. So in that period, when you find, if you read someone and it turns out they weren't actually Hanafi later on, you shouldn't at all be surprised because the period was still an organic moment where things were still growing and becoming crystallized over a few centuries as well. And what we really call a legal school today was really people who kind of accepted some sort of legal norm. So they didn't say we're Hanafis. They would say, okay, well, this method that I picked up from my teacher and the scholars that I stick around, it makes sense to me. So it was kind of like a legal norm more than a Hanafi madhab, if you like, as well. So this had a variety of meanings. Now, I want to mention about the Jawahir a little bit more. Where did he get his sources from? Because this book, of course, was written, as you can see, the author died 775, and he wrote the book towards the end of his life. There's a few centuries before that we need to account for. Which books was he taking his sources from? So where did he get these details about these so-called semi-Hanafis and Hanafis? And I mean, there's many sources. One of them, well, in fact, let's go to the introduction. Introduction to the Jawahir al-Mughiyah, the author himself explains why he wrote it. He says that people had compiled biographical dictionaries devoted to the ulama of their school. And he claims that there was no Hanafi scholar who'd done something similar. So there, he claims that there was an absence of this in the Hanafi madhab. But when you look at, for example, the Shafi'i, Abu Asim Muhammad bin Ahmad al-Abadi, who died in 458, he says that he wrote his Kitab al-Tafaqat al-Shafi'iyya, which is very, very famous, which was written more than three centuries before Ibn Abi al-Wafa. He actually says he was following the examples of the Hanafis. So it's interesting. Ibn Abi Wafa saying no one's written a book on the Hanafi biographical sources, but you have a Shafi'i three centuries before saying, no, I wrote my book based on what I saw the Hanafis doing. So this is kind of interesting. So there were, from what we can see, other biographical sources written by Hanafi ulama. And so we need to ask the question, well, who were they? And there are many. One of them is the famous Egyptian Hanafi alim, who actually moved from the Shafi'i madhab to the Hanafi madhab. Maybe we'll cover him later on. Abu Ja'far al-Tahawi, which is called Tariq al-Kabir. And there's also other books, for example, by Muhammad bin Abdul Malik bin Ibrahim al-Hamadani, who is described actually in the Jawahir as the author of Tabaqat al-Hanafiyya wa al-Shafi'iyya. So we know that Ibn al-Wafa is citing sources much more early on, in the 5th century or the 4th century. Now, one of them is quite important. One of the sources that is used here is this one.